When I set out to make these videos back in January, my original goal had been to simply expand on some earlier remarks I had made in a video about Jordan Peterson a few years ago. Now here I am 9 months later with over 6 hours of material. Now, due to various concerns and technical limitations, I decided to split part two, quote-unquote, into four chapters and an epilogue. To be clear, this series isn't so much about a video game as you might think. It's a window into the way American history has been distorted and weaponized on the long march toward the destruction of Western civilization, along with the people who created it. Some of the historical topics discussed hereafter are Wounded Knee, the Boxer Rebellions, the Transatlantic Railroad, the No Irish Need Apply mythos, early 20th century company towns, and the racial nature of early industrial labor movements. Perhaps this can shed some light on why I've done a 5-hour series on a single video game. Now, without further ado, let's begin. The first Bioshock, released in 2007, took place in an underwater city in the 1960s, and its foreground narrative focused primarily on an Ayn Rand-inspired objectivist dystopia. In the game's background was a deep-seated story of Jewish victimhood and distorted genius. Now, unlike the first game, however, Ken Levine's 2013 follow-up, Bioshock Infinite, made no attempt to obfuscate its central themes or its disdain toward the subject material. The exact level of hatred the game professes, specifically toward white men, reflects a very long historical strife between Jews and Gentiles. Bioshock Infinite takes place in 1912 in a white Christian ethnostate in the sky, after it seceded from a progressive America it felt was moving on without them. The game was praised by critics and journalists at the time as thoughtful historical commentary. Mother Jones called it, quote, an American history lesson where you get to blow shit up. VentureBeat told us that the game, quote, forces players to confront racism. In-game, the floating city in the sky is often referred to as New Eden, which is at once a biblical reference and a link to the game's motif of European colonialism. The white ethnostate's proper name, however, is Columbia, and is a fictional addition to the real-life World's Columbian Exposition of 1893, built in Chicago to commemorate the 400th anniversary of the arrival of Christopher Columbus. Historically, the term Columbia is just another name for Anglo-America, or prior to its independence, the British colonies. Its female personification following the Revolution became the American counterpart to the UK's Britannia, the Dutch Maiden, the French Marianne, and so on. The fictional city in Bioshock Infinite is superficially meant to be a what-if scenario, much like that within the first game's Rapture. But essentially, it's just a proxy to discuss American history in the context of modern culture wars. There's even a counterpart to the Statue of Liberty, simply called Lady Columbia, and it's no coincidence that the young male gamer is tasked with rescuing a young, attractive female trapped inside it. Virtually the entire plot revolves around her liberation from an overbearing Christian father and patriarchal racist society. The leader and founder of Columbia, Zachary Comstock, is an evangelical zealot who believes that the entire world outside his ethnostate must be destroyed with fire and brimstone. To say that Comstock is a caricature would be an understatement. There has never been a notable figure or religious movement in American history that thought in such extreme terms. Essentially, Ken Levine was playing narrative Legos with various elements of American history to create a sort of composite scapegoat. With this in mind, perhaps one of the most breathtaking instances of Ken Levine's chutzpah is that the political party and movement that has been suggested to most closely align with that found within his fictional Columbia is the Know-Nothing Party. Founded in 1844, it by no means proposed genocide, but it was an anti-Catholic populist movement. Moreover, its first leader, Louis Charles Levin, bizarrely not only shared a common surname with Ken Levine, but was also the very first Jewish congressman. Now, we'll discuss Lewis Levin in more detail much later, but Ken Levine's composite caricatured wasp, Zachary Comstock, was probably based off the real-life anti-vice activist Anthony Comstock. Now, this is not officially stated by the developers, but Anthony did live during the period. He was born into a town called New Canaan, which is highly synonymous with New Eden. As a young man, he moved to New York City, where he waged an epic battle to rid the city of smut, and all throughout Bioshock Infinite, New York City is depicted as the first target in Columbia's war against the Sodom Below. One of Anthony Comstock's biographers, Amy Verbel, wrote that Comstock focused, quote, on crushing women who preached sexual liberation or even simply advocated recognition of female desire, unquote. She also saw Comstock's prosecution of a homosexual professor who had led young boys back to his apartment to show pornographic material to as, quote, unequal justice, unquote. She also said this, quote, if nothing else, Comstock's story should prove the fundamentally unwinnable nature of his cause in this battle. Despite his energy and dedication, Comstock could not stop the profound and inexorable cultural and technological changes that were taking place in a nation, growing ever more pluralistic, progressive, and innovative. Change, driving and unstoppable, proved a crucial obstacle to his life's work. His efforts should serve today primarily as a cautionary tale, unquote. Now, the reason I bring all of this up, despite it not pertaining directly to the game, is because this same attitude of Amy's is very reminiscent of Ken Levine's attitude toward the characters in his fictional Columbia. That is, that America was progressing in 1912 such that all these racist, misogynist, xenophobes found it utterly unbearable.
Columbia was once actually part of America and then decided to, you know, separate itself from America. Yeah. All this at the same time, it still is identifying itself as American and more American than America actually is.
Yeah, you know, they were frustrated with the what they saw as the weakness of the rest of America's commitment to the mission, and so they.
Now, what mission Ken is referring to here is unclear. It certainly can't be the civilizing mission contained within the doctrines of Manifest Destiny, since those are the very things the game sets out to condemn elsewhere. Moreover, in 1896, segregation was legally upheld in Plessy v. Ferguson. In 1902, we made the Chinese Exclusion Act permanent. In 1917, we imposed a general ban on immigration from Asia. In 1924, the Johnson-Reed Act set up a quota system that favored immigration from Northwest Europe. It really wasn't until 1965 that things began to change with the Hart-Celler Act. So to assert that in 1912, a certain racist segment of Americans felt frustrated by a progressive, inclusive, anti-racist America moving on without them is a kind of bizarre retrospective wish fulfillment. The problem Ken had, I suppose, was that a more accurate historical context couldn't quite make sense of Columbia's existence or secession if Colombians more or less believed what normal Americans did. So Ken created Comstock in his caricatured America that sought to destroy the world and enslave black people again. He then contrasted this irrationally extremist ahistorical America against a contrived, anachronistically inclusive America that modern gamers with modern sensibilities could then feel that they were protecting.
Jesus!
The protagonist, and I do use that term quite loosely here, is one Booker DeWitt, whose Dutch surname curiously means the white or the blonde. Much of the game focuses on DeWitt's guilt for his past spent as a Pinkerton agent suppressing workers' rights, and his participation in the 7th Cavalry's supposed massacre of Native Americans at Wounded Knee. The ending reveals that DeWitt is actually the same person as Zachary Comstock, albeit from a different dimension. The idea is that you, the player, were the villain all along. Whereas Comstock became a born-again Christian to wash himself of his sins at Wounded Knee in the Pinkerton Agency, DeWitt had turned to gambling and vice to cope with his guilt. There's a cliche here about conservative Christians at heart being the very thing they seek to suppress, but we won't talk about that. In any event, DeWitt amassed a sizable amount of debt and sold his daughter, Anna DeWitt, to Zachary Comstock in the other dimension, who tropishly, like all nationalist leaders, was sterile. While the great reveal in the first game was that Andrew Ryan wasn't the real antagonist, but rather Frank Fontaine was, the great reveal in Bioshock Infinite is that you are the very person whom you thought you were fighting against. And unlike the first game, there is no path to redemption. You must allow all your daughters from infinite realities drown you at a baptismal font, because no matter which path DeWitt chooses, the outcome is evil. If all this sounds disjointed, don't worry, we're about to go through most of the game line by line, but a basic overview was due for folks already familiar with the content. Now, if you've never played the game, it's essentially Ken Levine's attempt to simultaneously condemn American history and rewrite it. Since Ken made quantum mechanics such a central theme in the game, you can think of his America, juxtaposed against his Columbia, as a historical argumentative quantum superposition. On one hand, the game will present America as an evil nation created by white people just for themselves. But then the game will also present America as having been created for everyone to enjoy, and that evil white Christian men came along and perverted this true meaning of America. The game repeatedly reassembles recontextualized historical memes and tropes as necessary to make white Christian America look as evil as it possibly can. In essence, the game is a rallying cry for the overthrow of America and the eradication of its progeny, whom the game literally points to in the end and says, "You are a bad person and need to be dealt with accordingly."
I'm disgusted. Disgusting. Sick. Sick. Are you going to just sit there?
Your journey begins in a rowboat off the coast of Maine. A man and a woman wearing yellow raincoats accompany you. The woman states she doesn't believe in the exercise. The man states that one goes into an experiment knowing one could fail. The woman responds that you don't go into an experiment, however, knowing one has failed. The player can't know who these two people are, let alone what is being discussed, without having already played through the game. But this is the game's first signal that you have no free will. The woman hands you a box with your name engraved on it. Inside are a pistol, a pictogram code, and a picture of a girl whom you are to find and retrieve. Much like the first game, you arrive at a lighthouse. Outside is an ominous note. DeWitt is in debt to some bad people, and unless he brings that girl back to New York City, there will be consequences. Now, rather than Ayn Rand-themed statements about objectivism, you're greeted with vague biblical references once you enter the lighthouse. They speak of washing thyself of sins and leaving the Sodom below in order to ascend to a new Eden. At the top of the lighthouse, DeWitt finds and sits in a rocket chair that takes him to Columbia. Once docked there, he finds himself in a series of rooms decorated with stained glass windows and statues. The engravings speak of a prophet named Comstock, his wonderful wife, and their miracle child, known as the Lamb, or the Seed of the Prophet, who, as one inscription reads, quote, "shall sit the throne and drown in flame the mountains of man," unquote. The area DeWitt has been wandering about, however, is just the Welcome Center. To actually enter the city proper, you must first undergo ritual baptism.
Is it someone new? Someone from the Sodom below? Newly come to Columbia to be washed clean before our prophet, our founders, and our lord?
I just need passage into the city.
Passage to the city? Brother, the only way to Columbia is through rebirth in the sweet waters of baptism. Will you be cleansed, brother?
It's either this or turn around and get back on that rocket. Might as well get it over with.
Come and be cleansed. Hallelujah!
Hey.
I baptize you in the name of our prophet, in the name of our founders, and the name of our Lord. I don't know, brothers and sisters, but this one doesn't look clean to me.
I'm just going to be quite frank here. Jews despise baptism. Many will deny this, but it's just a thing.
Cheryl's sister is getting married.
Becky's getting married, really?
Yeah,
wow.
To a Jew. Marrying a Jew.
Really? Well,
yeah.
So am I. They make the best husbands.
And he's converting. He's getting baptized and the whole thing, whatever.
Really?
Yeah.
Stop!
Now, Larry!
What's the matter with you?
I thought that he was drowning him, okay? I'm sorry.
Bullshit, you didn't think he was drowning him? You just didn't want him to convert. So you came screaming down the hill to stop it.
Now, some people argue that Jews despise baptism because historically they were forced to undergo baptism. But actually, more often than not, Jews were simply given an ultimatum to convert or leave. Usually this was after a long bout of economic exploitation on their part and or involvement in forced circumcisions of their Christian slaves. Now, while such an ultimatum does violate modern sensibilities of absolute, unquestionable religious tolerance, the distinction should not be negated. Consider that, to enter Columbia, you are in fact given the same ultimatum. Accept baptism or don't, but you're not entering the Christian ethnostate until you do. This is probably quite meaningful from Ken's perspective, and I argue marks the first moment he begins leading the player down a path of self-loathing. After your ritual drowning by the glassy-eyed priest, you find yourself in front of three statues of the three most important founders of America: George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and Benjamin Franklin. The nearby NPCs are reciting a series of strange prayers, though instead of being Christian-based, they're based on a grotesquely exaggerated American chauvinism.
Our prophet fills our lungs with water, so they may better love the air.
He who crossed the Delaware with flaming sword and wings of angels, watch over me and lend me strength. Shield my mind from fear and doubt, so that I may hold fast against all invaders. Father Washington, hear my prayer.
A rebel against ignorance and tyranny, share with me your wisdom and let the light of your good judgment shine like a beacon through the darkness. Father Jefferson, hear my prayer.
By the sword,
and the scroll, and the key.
Amen.
Now, beyond a subtle reference to the Holy Trinity, the concept of the sword, the key, and the scroll are references to Washington's military prowess, Franklin's discoveries, and Jefferson's moral guidance. But really, Ken was just making fun of Americans he felt were a little too patriotic. The historical America he was supposedly exploring was mostly Protestant, and Protestants don't pray to saints. In fact, Protestants would see praying to the Founding Fathers as blasphemous. Intercession is actually a major point of contention between Catholics and Protestants, which is amusing since this game purports to highlight the ethnic divisions between Anglos and the Irish. But again, this game isn't really historical commentary. It's mimetic warfare against white Christian America, whom Ken views as an enemy of the Jewish people. As you take your first steps into the city proper, you're meant to be taken back by the marvelous aesthetics. The architecture is inspired by neoclassical and colonial design. Yet all this pristine beauty and splendor is purposefully juxtaposed against carefully curated NPC commentary.
Like does not matter to a Liberty Scout. There's no room for preference, only duty.
Salmstall's all right, I tell you. Says he's for faith, family, and fatherland. Who could be against all that?
No, I thought I detected a hint of an accent from our waiter.
This entire opening sequence is clearly not intended to be flattering toward the subject material. It pretty much seeks to convey that beneath this veneer resides a foundation of something quite dark and sinister. DeWitt spots Lady Columbia and realizes this is where the girl he needs to retrieve is located. A young boy then hands him a telegram from someone named Lutece, warning him not to choose the number 77 under any circumstances. Lutece is one of the figures in the rowboat from earlier who ferried DeWitt to the lighthouse. As it turns out, these two characters are actually twin siblings, or rather, two versions of the same person, one male, one female, from two different dimensions.
For what separates us now but a single chromosome?
DeWitt then wanders through some fairgrounds, showcasing all of Columbia's marvelous wonders. The big thing on display right away are the Vigors, which are indeed counterparts to the first game's plasmids. A big theme, as it turns out in the game, is that Columbia is from an alternate reality to Rapture, and these Vigors, along with much of the rest of the technology in Columbia, were actually stolen from Rapture. And yes, this is once again going down the path of the Nazis stole all the Jewish tech, much in the same way as was done with the Da'at Yishud facets of the Wolfenstein reboot. We'll focus more on this motif later, but for now, just consider that these Vigors, unlike Rapture's plasmids, don't turn their users into psychopathic monsters. The reason could just be a typical plot hole, but maybe Ken felt that racist white supremacists can't be given such an excuse for their behavior, because that would detract from their villainy. Players aren't exactly meant to sympathize with the Columbians. They aren't victims, they're oppressors. Speaking more to this point, in the same area we're introduced to the game's anti-establishment populist movement, the Vox Populi, who are led by a super high IQ black female genius.
The Vox Populi are on the loose. Who will hunt them down? Hey, you, handy with a rifle? Looking to do your part for Columbia? Show your skill by hunting down Daisy Fitzroy. And the...
There she is! Daisy Fitzroy!
Aha! He got the bonus!
Now, the game clearly sets this shooting gallery sequence up to be interpreted by gamers as Colombian state propaganda against its enemies. It ties into the historical American state propaganda against anarcho-communist movements at the time. The funny thing is, though, this game is itself propaganda against the historical American state. Though, try explaining that to certain people and their heads will explode, because in their minds, propaganda is just something white racists do. The fact that Daisy Fitzroy's Vox Populi was a Latin phrase meaning voice of the people certainly didn't make things easier for any gamers who happened to know what Vox Populi meant.
Vox Populi this, Vox Populi that. Now, what does Vox Populi even mean, for heaven's sake?
It's Latin. It means...
Latin.
As an aside, racist white women at the time from high society, such as this one here, probably would have known what Vox Populi meant. In fact, she probably would have known Greek in addition to Latin. She certainly wouldn't have scoffed at the idea of knowing Latin. But why let that get in the way of virtue signaling something about non-existent historical black geniuses running anarcho-communist movements? Moving on, DeWitt then leaves the fairgrounds and heads towards the raffle. In transit, however, he's confronted by the Lutece twins, though he doesn't appear to recognize them from the boat.
Heads.
Or tails.
Come on, let me through. Heads.
Or tails.
Heads. Told you.
I never find that as satisfying as I'd imagined.
Chin up. There's always next time.
I suppose there is.
If you look at the back of the chalkboard, heads has been marked off over 100 times, while tails has never been marked off. Yes, this is a reference to Rosencrantz and Guilderstern are dead, but it's also the second major in-game suggestion that the game's outcome will always be the same.
156 times.
Along his path to the raffle, DeWitt encounters a poster warning Colombians of the false shepherd, whose mark is coincidentally AD. As it just so happens, AD is branded on his own hand. He's confused about this, but presses on to the local raffle, where, wouldn't you know, he picks a ball with the number 77. Consider that DeWitt is a man who's in Colombia precisely because of his great misfortune, that is, his gambling debt. Yet, he won this raffle.
Sorry, no sale.
Silly, there's never a charge for the raffle. You've been sleeping under a rock?
77.
77, that's a lucky number. I'll be rooting for you.
Bring me the bowl! Is that not the prettiest young white girl in all of Colombia? All right, then. The winner is number 77!
Well, what do you know?
Over here! Over here! He's the winner!
Number 77, come and claim your prize! First throw!
First throw!
Please don't do this.
It was me. It was all me. Please. Please. No. Please, what are you doing?
Come on. Are you going to throw it? Or are you taking your coffee black these days?
Let her go, please. I'm the one you want.
Oh, looks like we've got a shy one here. We've got to do something about that.
Come on, please.
Time's a-wasting, my boy.
Please don't.
Why don't you give her a throw? Wait. It's him.
Now, where'd you get that brand, boy? Don't you know that makes you the backstabbing snake in the grass false shepherd?
The false shepherd!
And we ain't letting no false shepherd into our flock. Show them what we got planned, boys!
Stop him! Stop him! Shepherds come to lead our lamb astray!
The blatant language outlining Colombia's white racial politics stands out in stark contrast against the extremely elusive, vague insinuations of Jewish identity employed in the first Bioshock. The anti-white Christian symbolism is also quite apparent. Technically, AD stands for Booker DeWitt's daughter, Anna DeWitt, whom we learn about much later, but AD is also a reference to Anno Domini, the Latin phrase for the year of our Lord. According to myjewishlearning.com, quote, 7 is one of the greatest power numbers in Judaism, representing creation, good fortune, and blessing. A Hebrew word for luck, God, equals 7 in Gematria. Another Hebrew word for luck, Mazal, equals 77, unquote. The idea here is that Christians are the very thing they seek to condemn, and DeWitt's picking 77 is considered fortunate because it's the beginning of the end for Comstock's Christian ethnostate. From here on out, DeWitt, the atheist man of vice, will help Colombia destroy itself.
77. That's a lucky number. I'll be rooting for you.
As DeWitt leaves the raffle, he comes across a series of animal cages with monkey images on them. There's a nearby recording.
I told you, Comstock. You sell them paradise, and the customers expect cherubs for every chore. No menials in God's kingdom. Well, I have a man in Georgia who'll lease us as many Negro convicts as you can board. Why, you can say they're simple souls in penance for rising above their station. Whatever eases your conscience, I suppose.
So the racist white supremacists of Colombia built an ethnostate in the sky using quantum physics, as we find out later, and had access to mechanical horses, airships, and even artificial oceans. Yet they chose to import Negro convicts from the state of Georgia. The aim here, I suppose, is to explain the presence of blacks, even if it makes no sense, and to portray white Americans during this period as irrationally cruel and oppressive. Now, was there segregation in 1912? Yes, of course, there was segregation. But therein lies the problem. White Americans didn't want to import more black people. They wanted political, social, and physical separation from them. Exiting this area, DeWitt battles his way through more Colombian police until he happens upon Colombia's Friends of the Negro Society.
Violence is not the answer. As much as I support her cause and her people, blood must not be shed.
What do you expect these poor Negroes to do? How they treat them? It was bound to happen.
Violence is not a foregone conclusion.
Now, the dialogue between these two white abolitionists unknowingly reveals that Daisy Fitzroy's Vox Populi is really a black movement and not a pan-racial populist one. It's curious that the white lady here is justifying black-on-white violence because of how they treat them, as if she somehow won't be the target in the coming race war she sees as a foregone conclusion. Probably not intentional, but she's comically representative of a particular demographic of white liberals.
All right, I'm not like the rest. I'm a progressive.
More importantly here, is this game seeking to address the early 20th or the mid-19th century? The imagery on the Friends of the Negro Society's poster is quite reminiscent of abolitionist posters in New England circa 1850. Now, as much as Ken might want to blur the line between slavery and segregation, there was a difference. Now, with this in mind, let's listen to one of Ken's pre-release interviews.
Oh my God, that's what Columbia is. It is this sky I color. It is this world. It is the memory of America that people think existed that never really actually quite existed.
Is Ken claiming that racism, slavery, and segregation never really actually quite existed? Of course he's not. He's claiming that our collective idyllic memories of white America never really actually quite existed. The goal is a simultaneous denial of white America and a condemnation of it via a heavily curated presentation. Again, you can think of it as a historical argumentative quantum superposition. Exiting the Friends of the Negro Society, we cross paths again with more Colombian police officers and massacre them all. Off to the side is an abandoned Wild West display with a recording by a man named Preston Downs.
Comstock came by the wagon at dawn. Man was just transfixed by my trophy scalps. Asked about the white ones there. I said, well, sir, if your quarry dwells in the jungle and beds down with the local color, why split hairs? Not a chuckle out of him. Either he ain't seen a man go native, or maybe too many. Anyhow, now it's got me hunting down this Daisy Fitzroy. Hope he don't expect me to stuff and mount her.
This taps into two major tropes. One, that white settlers were abandoning their own kind in droves to go live among the natives. And two, that Western frontiersmen were committing endless atrocities against the wholly peaceful locals. First, be aware that scalping had been a practice of intertribal warfare in North America long before the white man ever showed up. In the book, A Population History of North America, authors Steckel and Haynes write, quote, "Probably the most dramatic skeletal example of prehistoric violence in North America comes from the Crow Creek site in central South Dakota. Archaeological excavations revealed about 486 skeletons within a fortification ditch on the periphery of the habitation area. The site represents the initial coalescent period and dates to about 1325 AD. P. Wiley's analysis revealed that 90% of the individuals had cut marks characteristic of scalping. Also common were depressed fractures and decapitation. Three examples of facial mutilation were also present. Clearly, the individuals buried at Crow Creek were victims of a massacre with abundant evidence of body mutilation," unquote. Now, reading through various literature does reveal that Europeans did engage in some periodic scalp bounties, but this appears to have been largely in response to native hostilities. One of the most famous instances of a European scalping Native Americans was Hannah Dustin. In 1697, her small town in Massachusetts was raided by Native Americans, who killed about 27 colonists, most of whom were children. Hannah was then captured, and the natives killed her newborn baby by smashing it against a tree. Long story short, Hannah became a local folk hero after she and her fellow captives killed and scalped their captors as they slept. Needless to say, Hannah likely won't be celebrated today as a feminist icon fighting back against her patriarchal oppressors. Now, as far as the killing of babies go, here's a clip of author and researcher Sam Gwynn explaining on the Joe Rogan Show that this was in fact a norm, especially among the Plains Indians.
Those rules had applied to Indian tribes since forever. You know, that was the assumption of a raid. They all had, it was almost like the golden rule in reverse, or the golden rule, do unto others. They all expected that kind of treatment. None of them were shocked when a baby was killed or a pregnant woman was killed. It took the kind of, the Anglo-European civilization of, you know, Newton and Leibniz and the biblical tradition to arrive on the Texas frontier in 1830 and be shocked at what they saw. Very interesting, very savage, very brutal. It was a culture of raiding, essentially.
Consider here that for the last several decades, pop culture's depictions of Native Americans have been exceedingly flattering, while the depictions of Europeans have been exceedingly unflattering. Take, for example, the case of John Ratcliffe, second president of Jamestown, that is, the first permanent English settlement in the New World. In the 1995 Disney film, he's inaccurately depicted as a greedy and ruthless villain who was after the local Powhatan Indians' non-existent gold. He tries to dupe the colonists into waging a war against the otherwise peaceful Powhatans, but the plot is uncovered and he's imprisoned for treason. In reality, though, John Ratcliffe was brutally murdered by the Powhatan Indians. When the colonists were running short of supplies in December of 1609, the current president, George Percy, sent Ratcliffe, along with some other colonists, to trade with the Powhatans. According to Percy's account, the Powhatan leader at first made it seem as if he were going to trade, but was really only waiting for an opportune moment to ambush the men. The natives lured the men, under false pretenses, into different dwellings to separate them. Most were killed outright, but John Ratcliffe was tied up, and their women removed his skin from his entire body with mussel shells, and then tossed the pieces into a fire as he watched. Then they burned him alive. Immediately following this nasty affair, that same night, the Powhatans killed 600 of the colonists' hogs at Jamestown, and then began driving off the deer in the forest to deprive them of food. Now, it should be stressed here that in 1607, when the very first Englishmen landed in the Jamestown region, they were attacked. So, in many ways, one can argue that the Native Americans themselves set the general tone for how future interactions would go. Yet, you won't get even a hint at such a perspective in Bioshock Infinite. And, putting aside Ken's biases, that's hardly surprising, given when the game was released. Again, though, the game isn't so much a historical analysis, but rather a careful curation of tropes and cliches intended to lead players down a path of guilt and self-loathing. Returning to the game's plot, DeWitt now approaches the Fraternal Order of the Raven. Outside, the atmosphere quickly transitions from a clear blue sky to a foggy, macabre overcast, complete with cawing ravens. On the front of the gate sits the Eye of Providence, a prominent symbol used by the American founders to represent God's omnipotence. Above are the words, "Audemus Patria Nostra Defendere," which is meant to convey, "We dare defend our homeland." Past the gate, we're confronted with a statue of Comstock fighting a Serpent of Nations. The hydra-like creature has gross caricatures of a Jewish, Black, and Asian man for its three heads. Curiously, each one of these groups has engaged in their own xenophobic wars to expel foreigners. The Israeli military, for example, even had an operation in 1948 called Death to the Invader, which was an interesting name, since the goal was to link a Jewish enclave in the Negev Desert surrounded by Arab-Palestinian villages with the rest of Israel. Now, to get back on point, the inspiration for this Serpent of Nations statue likely came from a real-life instance, albeit distorted. While Anthony Comstock was likely a racist by today's standards, he wasn't exactly consumed by racialist thought, perhaps because very few people at the time seriously questioned the concept. Whatever the case, Anthony Comstock wasn't an anti-immigration activist or even a racial advocate. He was best known for his anti-obscenity measures that were passed into law in 1873. In a letter he wrote to New York Representative Clinton Merriam, which was appended to a congressional hearing that resulted in the passage of the act, Anthony referred to a cache of pornographic material he had seized as, quote, "a hydra-headed monster," unquote. And in case you're wondering, no, Ken Levine would not have needed to scour various historical archives to come across this seemingly vague reference when it's often mentioned in mainstream biographies. Now, Hydra is a mythical beast that was killed by Hercules as part of his great deeds. It's often remembered as a daunting task, specifically because the heads kept growing back after he cut off each one. Comstock probably made the reference to Hydra because the salacious material he had confiscated appeared to be without end, and he also likened himself to Hercules fighting a monstrous villain. Inside the Fraternal Order of the Raven, we enter a small foyer with several 19th century paintings of white men. To the right and left, we find clothing racks with clan robes. Crossing into the atrium, we see a statue of John Wilkes Booth, which is a signal, I suppose, that these clansmen worship Lincoln's assassin. To the left is a bar full of members of this fraternal order, who, of course, attack you on sight, because why wouldn't clansmen immediately attack a perfectly normal-looking white man? Now, if you're observant, you can see two paintings on the wall. One is of Abraham Lincoln as a shadowy, evil demon looming over America. The other is of George Washington and bears a striking resemblance to the historical 1872 piece by John Gast entitled American Progress, which has come to symbolize manifest destiny and westward expansion. On the bar is a recording of Zachary Comstock.
"And when the angel Mitchell Columbia gave unto the founders the tools to build a new Eden, they did so without hesitation. For 85 years they prepared the way of the Lord. But when the great apostate came, he brought war with him, and the fields of Eden were soaked with the blood of brothers. The only emancipation he had to offer was death.
The great apostate in Comstock's mind is, of course, Abraham Lincoln. Ironically, though, the real-life Anthony Comstock not only fought for the Union Army, but his family in New Canaan, Connecticut, lost its farm to Southern sympathizers who foreclosed on the mortgage because the Comstock boys had decided to fight for the Yankees. Again, this game is an assemblage of historical components, the sum total of which equals gross misrepresentation. Again, more than likely, Comstock was a racist by today's standards, but to the best of my knowledge, he never even commented publicly on race, nor did he write any books about it. In the adjacent area, we encounter an indoor Klan rally.
And so, the prophet led us into Peking, where we demonstrated to the sovereign below the true mission our founders had given us. And when the mandarins and hypocrites of Washington betrayed him, our prophet did not heal. He did not come crawling for their forgiveness. Like our fathers broke with the great apostate, our prophet broke with these so-called patriots. And today is the day we celebrate this secession.
This cartoonishly evil speech here is a reference to another story element that you acquire piecemeal over the course of the game. In 1901, Columbia had invaded China and blew up the city of Peking in retaliation for the Boxer Rebellion. In response to this, the American government told Comstock to stand down and to return to Washington, which then prompted Columbia's secession. We'll talk about this more later. For now, just remember that while America never blew up a Chinese city in 1901, it did invade the South during the Civil War and reduce much of it to rubble. The term Reconstruction was just as literal as it was figurative. Now, once we kill all the racists, we can finally examine the giant portrait of George Washington with a beautiful white girl sitting on his shoulders. He's holding a Liberty Bell and a stone tablet of the Ten Commandments. Surrounding him are unflattering depictions of mostly non-white foreigners, although note the Irishmen and what appear to be Slavs. There's a scroll for wisdom, the Eye of Providence for faith, a sword for defense, and a key for discovery. Above are written the words, "For God and Country." Nearby is another recording of Comstock.
What exactly was the great emancipator emancipating the Negro from? From his daily bread, from the nobility of honest work, from wealthy patrons who sponsored them from cradle to grave, from clothing and shelter. And what have they done with their freedom? Why, go to Finkton and you shall find out. No animal is born free, except the white man. And it is our burden to care for the rest of creation.
Comstock's attitude here is much more in line with antebellum slave owners than it is New England evangelicals at any point in time, let alone 1912. Now, putting that aside, what's being referenced here is The White Man's Burden, a poem written in 1899 by an Englishman, Rudyard Kipling. The poem calls upon the white man to take up the mantle of bringing civilization to the rest of the world, specifically the Philippines, following the Spanish-American War. Now, while Kipling's poem did espouse imperialist ambitions, he didn't intend for white Americans to enslave the black man again, as may be implied by Zachary Comstock's Voxophone recording. The poem is quite advanced, but I'm going to read it here and then briefly discuss its general character and what it seeks to convey. Quote, "Take up the white man's burden, send forth the best ye breed, go bind your sons to exile to serve your captive's need. To wait in heavy harness on fluttered falcon wild, your new-caught sullen peoples, half devil and half child. Take up the white man's burden, impatience to abide, to veil the threat of terror and check the show of pride. By open speech and simple, 100 times made plain, to seek another's profit and work another's gain. Take up the white man's burden, the savage wars of peace, fill full the mouth of famine, and bid the sickness cease. And when your goal is nearest, the end for others sought, watch sloth and heathen folly bring all your hopes to naught. Take up the white man's burden, no iron rule of kings, but toil of serf and sweeper, the tale of common things. The ports ye shall not enter, the roads ye shall not tread. Go make them with your living, and mark them with your dead. Take up the white man's burden, and reap his old reward, the blame of those ye better, the hate of those ye guard. The cry of hosts ye humor, ah, slowly, toward the light. Why brought ye us from bondage, our loved Egyptian knight? Take up the white man's burden, ye dare not stoop to less, nor call too loud on freedom to cloak your weariness. By all ye will or whisper, by all ye leave or do, the silent sullen peoples shall weigh your God and you. Take up the white man's burden, have done with childish days, the lightly proffered laurel, the easy ungrudged praise, comes now to search your manhood through all the thankless years, cold, edged with dear-bought wisdom, the judgment of your peers. Many of the poem's lines are highly offensive to modern egalitarian sensibilities, but Kipling was not calling for the white man to rule over a world of non-white chattel slaves absent any rights. Pay close attention and you'll see that he was, in a real sense, calling for the white man to enslave himself for the benefit of others, to build them ports, schools, and hospitals, to sacrifice our children to see it done, and to seek nothing in return. Now, I do have issues with this sentiment, but consider today that anti-whites have no issues dragging us and our children, kicking and screaming from what they perceive to be our racist, barbaric Egyptian knight. Interestingly, parts of the poem were read before Congress as annexation of the Philippines was being discussed. Senator Tillman from South Carolina, who, interestingly, had been a member of the Red Shirts during the Reconstruction era, curiously used Kipling's poem to argue against annexation. I will now read from his statement. Quote, "I wish to call attention to a fact which may have escaped the attention of senators thus far, that with 5 exceptions, every man in this chamber who has had to do with the colored race in this country voted against the ratification of the treaty. It was not because we are Democrats, but because we understand and realize what it is to have 2 races side by side that cannot mix or mingle without deterioration and injury to both, and the ultimate destruction of the civilization of the higher. We of the South have borne this white man's burden of a colored race in our midst since the emancipation, and before. It was a burden upon our manhood and our ideas of liberty before they were emancipated. It is still a burden, although they have been granted the franchise. It clings to us like the shirt of Nessus, and we are not responsible because we inherited it, and your fathers, as well as ours, are responsible for the presence amongst us of that people. Why do we, as a people, want to incorporate into our citizenship 10 millions more of different or of differing races, 3 or 4 of them? Those peoples are not suited to our institutions. They are not ready for liberty as we understand it. They do not want it. Why are we bent on forcing upon them a civilization not suited to them, and which only means, in their view, degradation and a loss of self-respect, which is worse than the loss of life itself?" Unquote. Unfortunately, Tillman was ignored and the Philippines were indeed annexed, which admittedly does speak to the points critics of American exceptionalism and imperialism have made. But Tillman's attitude was perfectly in line with how Abraham Lincoln himself felt about blacks. Much like Thomas Jefferson, who himself favored eventual abolition, Lincoln felt that blacks and whites could not cohabitate the same political space. In his presidential debate with Douglas in 1858, he said, quote, "I will say then that I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races. That I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes. nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say in addition to this that there is a physical difference between the white and black races, which I believe will forever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality." Unquote. In 1862, Lincoln said the following to a committee of freed blacks with regards to what he saw as their inevitable departure from America. Quote, "Your race are suffering, in my judgment, the greatest wrong inflicted on any people. But even when you cease to be slaves, you are yet far removed from being placed on an equality with the white race. You are cut off from many of the advantages which the other race enjoy. The aspiration of men is to enjoy equality with the best when free. But on this broad continent, not a single man of your race is made the equal of a single man of ours. Go where you are treated the best, and the ban is still upon you." Unquote. Perhaps the possible irony here is that most actual Klansmen would undoubtedly prefer historical Lincoln over fictional Comstock, because Lincoln wouldn't have imported Negro convicts into their ethnostate. In this sense, Comstock's political doctrine was misguided as far as the Founding Fathers would be concerned. They didn't wish to import non-whites in any capacity, free or enslaved. Consider that even the importation of slaves was outlawed in 1807. In the next room, we view a projector displaying a phrenological study of Comstock and two Native Americans. Phrenology, invented in 1796, was a pseudoscience that involved the measurement of bumps on the skull to predict mental traits. But phrenology was no longer taken seriously by the late 1840s. So its inclusion here in a 1912 setting is little more than another anachronism meant to smear Columbians, that is, racially aware white people and anyone who believes in aggregate racial differences, as deranged quacks. Up ahead, we see a man torn apart by a swarm of ravens, and there's absolutely no explanation given as to why. It just happens, because why not? These are racist white people. Cages with dead bodies hang from the ceiling, and in the center of the room is a statue of Lady Comstock, who is a central figure in this bizarre Raven Clan's religious practices. After killing everyone in the room, we hear a woman on a loudspeaker giving a description of the false shepherd.
"The false shepherd, this anarchist, is either a mulatto dwarf or a Frenchman with a missing left eye, no more than 4 feet and 9 inches.
Due to the current state of emergency in Colombia, the city's gondola system has been closed, so Booker DeWitt uses the magnetic skyhook he acquired at the raffle to travel along the sky rails. Along the way to Monument Island, at a maintenance station, he finds another recording by Comstock.
"And the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great, and he repented he had made man on the earth. Rain, 40 days and 40 nights of the stuff, and he left not a thing that walked alive. You see, my friends, even God is entitled to a do-over. And what is Columbia if not another ark for another time?"
Very slowly, over the course of the game, Ken Levine is telling the player that white secessionist movements aren't really about sovereignty, but rather dominance and supremacy. Essentially, he's telling the player that if white people are ever allowed to secede or go their own way, they will invariably seek to exterminate everyone else. The contrivance of Comstock's genocidal doctrine here takes extreme liberties with the history of white Christian America. The reality is that no one ever preached that America was an ark and that the rest of the world needed to be drowned in fire and brimstone. If anything, the idea was always that America's liberalism should be exported to other nations, which is a kind of crime in and of itself, but that should not be viewed as fire and brimstone genocide. Now, if Kim wanted to base his genocidal narratives on something a little bit more accurate, he could have based them on the Talmud or the Tanakh. Take, for example, Samuel 15:3. Quote, "Now go, attack Amalek, and prescribe all that belongs to him. Spare no one, but kill alike men and women, infants and sucklings, oxen and sheep, camels and asses." Unquote. DeWitt continues along the sky rail system until he comes upon more Colombian troops, who suddenly kneel and begin to pray to the Founding Fathers of America.
"I know why you've come, false. false shepherd. I see every sin that blackens your soul. Wounded knee, the Pinkertons, the drink, the gambling, and of course, Anna. And now, to repay a debt, you've come from my land. But not all debts can be repaid, Booker.
You don't know me, pal.
Prophecy is my business, Mr. DeWitt. As blood as yours. Do you know why these men will die for me? Because I have seen their future in the glory. And hence they are content. What brought you to Columbia, Booker? Bring us the girl and wipe away the debt? This will end in blood, DeWitt. But then again, it always does with you, doesn't it? It always ends in blood.
This is when we're first told about DeWitt's past at Wounded Knee and the Pinkerton Agency. We also hear about Anna, his daughter, for the first time, though at this point neither DeWitt or the player know who Anna is, let alone that she and Elizabeth are the same person. It's just a mysterious name. Comstock also alludes to the game's eventual overarching theme that, with you, these things always end in blood.
Smother him in the crab.
Smother.
From here, you jump aboard his nearby airship, which he isn't actually on. You enter the control room, hoping to use the ship to fly directly to Monument Island. Inside, a woman worships at an altar of Comstock. She ignores you, so you proceed to the controls, at which point, Comstock appears outside the control window.
Okay, I'm sure I can get this thing going.
The Lord forgives everything. But I'm just a prophet. So I don't have to. Amen.
Amen.
Jesus!
Now, I can't believe I actually have to say this, but no, there was never any suicidal Christian sect in America that would set themselves on fire to kill their enemies. Moreover, consider here that this woman simply could have walked out while DeWitt was listening to Comstock, locked the door behind her, and then set the ship on fire before abandoning it. Setting herself on fire was just melodrama meant to convey, once again, that white Christians are deranged and mindless followers of their sadistic religious leaders. After escaping, DeWitt finally arrives at Monument Island. Yet curiously, despite the suicidal attempts to kill him, he isn't followed, and no one is guarding the arguably most important site in all of Columbia, the house guarding the seat of the prophet that shall drown in flame the mountains of man. Inside the atrium is the recording of a black worker.
I guess even in a restricted area, these crackers need someone to clean the floors. Those politicians and scientists don't bother about what they say around me, because I'm some half-leaded colored boy. But I can tell they scared out of their wits by that thing they got locked upstairs. Yes, sir. They got a tiger by the tail, and they don't know whether to hang on or run.
Note the black man calling white people crackers has pinups of crackers in his locker. Regardless, Mr. Bradley's most important contribution to the story here is his colorful reference to the very powerful female these white men are deathly afraid of and have locked away in the Statue of Liberty. Up ahead is a chart referencing a female's age progression, then a strange set of gadgets that cycle objects between two different super quantum states, one being a cloth with the label Menarche. Farther down the hall, we can watch a film of the subject, clearly a girl, trying to lockpick her way out of her captivity. Note the repeated language all throughout the facility that refers to this girl as the specimen. This is supposed to convey a sense of white male objectification of women. In the adjacent room are several photos being developed of the specimen, the aim of their presence probably being to elicit a creepy voyeurism vibe. The whole date rape, torture undertone is increased even more so in the next room, where there's a chair with straps and a warning sign about only operating once soporific agents have been applied. Continuing on, we find a very large room with giant speakers and gadgets all flowing with electricity. We can hear a distorted sound of a young woman humming, In front of us is a chalkboard with the words "Facility Unsafe" written in large yellow letters, indicating that the specimen became exceedingly dangerous once she hit puberty. On the table is another recording by Comstock.
It is one thing to imagine one's future, and another to see it. I have seen the seeds of fire that will prepare the Sodom below for the coming of the Lord. But Elizabeth shall sow those seeds, not I. I will fall before the job is done. But she shall take up my mantle. The Lord is calling me home. I feel his love in every tumor, because they are the train which takes me to his station. And I go with joy, knowing that Elizabeth will take my earthly place. But the false shepherd is coming to lead my lamb astray. I will not board that train until she is safe from his deceptions.
The signs around this siphon device tell us that its purpose is to leech the specimen, though at this point we don't know what that means exactly. Later, we learn that the device prevents Elizabeth from realizing her full potential in terms of her power with interdimensional tears. From here, we ride an elevator up to a room with an observation window. We open it, thinking we may find Elizabeth, but behind it is just one of her abandoned decoding projects. Again, note that the game is heavily centered on codes, ciphers, and hidden messages. We move on to the dressing room, where we finally encounter Elizabeth. She holds up her pinky finger with a slight grimace, revealing a thimble covering a deformity. Then she holds up a postcard of the Eiffel Tower and giddily runs out of the room. DeWitt follows to the next observation window. She touches her deformed pinky again, then turns to a painting of the Eiffel Tower.
Whoa! What is...
Note that this portal is to Paris, that the sign reads "The Revenge of the Jedi," and that the music playing in the background is "Everybody Wants to Rule the World" by Tears for Fears. Elizabeth then once again leaves the room, and DeWitt follows and attempts to access the library, but falls through the ceiling in the process.
Hello? Hey! Knock it off! Stop it! Will you stop it? Not here to hurt you.
Who are you?
My name is DeWitt. I'm a friend. I come to get you out
get
of here.
Get away! Are you real?
I'm real enough.
He's coming. You've got to go.
Why?
You don't want to be here when he gets here. Just a minute, I'm getting dressed.
I can get you out of here.
There's no way out. Trust me, I've looked. Stop it, you're too impatient. That's enough.
What about this?
What about it?
This is the way out, isn't it?
What are you... Give it to me. It's a way out.
Elizabeth seems surprisingly well adjusted for a young woman who's been locked away in a tower and tortured for her entire life. Regardless, note the symbolism on the key: a cage indicating imprisonment and a bird indicating freedom. As the two of you run down the hallways, the tower comes under attack from the giant mechanical bald eagle known as Songbird. At the elevator, Elizabeth discovers that she's been watched the entire time and subsequently has an emotional moment.
What is all this? They were watching me? All this time? Why? Why did they put me in here? What am I? What am I?
You're the girl who's getting out of this tower!
You'd expect someone who'd been tortured and experimented on their entire life to not be so surprised by the fact that they were being watched. The scene, however, is supposed to cement how nefarious the Colombian patriarchs are and signal more creepy voyeurism. And this is best done by Elizabeth expressing shock and bewilderment. Immediately after this, Songbird attacks DeWitt through the wall, but eventually relents, and the two characters make their way up through the Statue of Liberty. I'm not entirely sure why they went up, since there's no way to escape. I suppose it was important to have a sequence where the two fall from the tower and latch onto the sky rails, so that the player could have a great view of the Statue of Liberty collapsing. The sky rail becomes damaged in the chaos, and the two characters fall hundreds, maybe thousands of feet, into Columbia's artificial ocean, Battle Bay. DeWitt is then rendered unconscious and has a brief dream sequence wherein he's back in his New York office.
Mr. DeWitt! Mr. DeWitt! Bring us the girl and wipe away the debt! Are you in there, DeWitt?
What do you want with her?
We had a deal, DeWitt!
Tell me what you want with her.
Open this door right now!
Are you going to hurt her? Tell me what you want! Anna? Anna? Anna. Anna.
No, it's me, Elizabeth. Are you all right?
Where am I?
Back in the land of the living. Here, let me.
I'll be fine.
You almost drowned. You need to...
I said I'm fine. Just give me a minute.
Do you hear that? Oh, it's music.
Yeah, go on. I just need to...
Okay, I won't be long. I won't be long, Mr. DeWitt.
Where is she?
From here, DeWitt wanders about the beach looking for Elizabeth. A voxophone from Comstock's biographer, Ed Gaines, is nearby.
The prophet may know how his own biography is going to end, but I can scarcely fathom how I'm going to start it. I mean, other than the kid's stuff you get at the Hall of Heroes, anything prior to his baptism was, and here I quote, hang on, left on the riverside. They'll call me a plagiarist, but I'm going to spend the first 30 pages regurgitating scripture.
Ken must have written this, completely ignoring the fact that virtually every prime minister of Israel has quoted and cited religious Jewish texts in almost every action they undertook.
Adonai oz le'amo yiten, Adonai yevarech et amo v'shalom.
Also note that Comstock's biographer is already suggesting that the player dismisses rhetoric outright because it pulls from childhood propaganda and boring scripture. After this, DeWitt stumbles upon a group of women chatting on the beach.
Everything's changing. People don't know their place anymore.
Tell me about it. An Oriental stopped me on the street and asked me for the time. Just like that. There should be a law. I think there is.
Note the women here are discussing how things are changing in a disagreeable fashion. This is once again another allusion Ken was making to an ahistorical, progressive, inclusive America that racists felt was moving on without them. Let's also appreciate the fact that Colombia, in theory, exists as an ethno-nationalist secession movement. Yet, these Colombian women are here complaining about the very problems they were supposed to have left behind in that progressive, inclusive America moving on without them. Again, this game isn't so much about a what-if scenario so much as it's just anti-white propaganda.
This is the life.
I miss real beaches.
On real beaches, you've got to contend with all types of people sharing the water. Those people are not sanitary.
That's silly.
They get diseases you couldn't imagine. You don't believe me? Take a trip to Finkton.
Now, to be clear, I'm not denying that beaches in 1912 were segregated, or that white people generally felt, to one degree or another, that non-whites carried more diseases. But maybe, just maybe, these white people weren't being quite as irrational as these caricatures here would suggest.
Don't touch a friend. Do you guys ever worry about Ebola? Do you think that's real?
No.
The last notable NPC commentary here is the lifeguard's mention of Charles Darwin.
Damn fools should let them drown themselves.
Thin out the herd.
Well, that's positively Darwinian.
Whatever do you mean?
Darwin? Charles Darwin.
Hey, keep your voice down.
This is probably a good time to mention that this game came out at a time when internet atheism was still pretty popular. A year after this was released, Bill Nye famously debated Ken Ham. So this line of dialogue here, I assume, is meant to dunk on Christian fundamentalists who believe the Earth is 6,000 years old. The thing is, Darwin was a racist by today's standards. In his book, The Descent of Man, he uses the word savage 248 times and divides mankind into, quote, the highest races and the lowest savages, unquote. On page 97, he states, quote, the chief causes of the low morality of savages, as judged by our standard, are, firstly, the confinement of sympathy to the same tribe, unquote. Though, like Lincoln, Darwin detested slavery and the abuses it entailed. There are numerous writings of his that speak to this, which we're not going to get into because of time restrictions. The main point I'm trying to make here is that the shitlibs who put this Darwin line in the game did so to own the Christians, yet they own themselves because Darwin would have looked on the shitlibs and their notions of racial egalitarianism much the same way these shitlibs view fundamentalist Christians. That is, Darwin would have seen them as giant ignoramuses. In any event, eventually DeWitt spots Elizabeth dancing on a nearby dock.
Oh, this is wonderful! Well, come dance with me, Mr. DeWitt!
I don't dance. Come on, let's go.
Why? What could be better than this?
Well, how about Paris?
Paris? I don't understand. How could we get there?
That's where that airship's going, but if you want to stay and dance, we can...
No, let's go! Come on, let's go! Come on, let's go right now! I'm out. It's hard to believe, but it's true, isn't it? Oh, can you smell that? I've never smelled anything like that before, have you?
Beaches I know don't smell much like that.
Left! Now jump! Jump!
Mr. DeWitt, Comstock. I've read about him. They say he can see the future.
Give a man a little power, he falls in all kinds of love with himself.
I don't like his look.
Do you dislike the look of the prophet or his gaze?
Can we leave now?
A couple things stand out about this sequence. One is that Elizabeth's obsession with Paris is reiterated. Another is that, as soon as you leave the dock, the background music changes to a rendition of Cyndi Lauper's Girls Just Want to Have Fun, as Elizabeth becomes ever more excited about her newfound freedom. Oh, girls just wanna have fun. Up ahead on the boardwalk, we're confronted again by the Lutece twins, who give us a choice between two pieces of jewelry for Elizabeth.
Look at these, they're amazing! Which one do you like more, this one or this? The bird is beautiful, and the cage is somber, but there's really something special about it. I just can't decide.
The one on the left.
Are you sure?
I'm sure.
Now, there are no consequences for either choice, but the canon choice is that Elizabeth gets the bird, as seen in the DLC Burial at Sea. Nevertheless, the game is asking the player if they would free Elizabeth or imprison her. Now, the game never made it very apparent, but the reason everyone on the beach didn't flip out over the Statue of Liberty being destroyed was because of overcast. Once you choose Elizabeth's jewelry, however, the clouds clear and the Colombians finally realize what physical and symbolic damage has been done to their Christian ethnostate.
How could this happen? Why didn't the prophet foresee this?
Who knows what the prophet sees? He tells us what he deems wise. It's okay. It's okay.
Oh, Frederick!
The NPC's dialogue here is essentially held up for white middle-class midwits to fixate on. These Colombians may be dressed in fine attire, but Irrational Games makes it very clear that these racists are a collective, low-class sheeple, And that's the last thing a white middle-class midwit wants to be seen as. Low-class and sheep-like. Again, in many ways, this game does not establish the mimetic tropes it uses, but it curates them very effectively.